Blog Talk Radio.
The place to be.
Why not?
Good evening. Hi, hi. And welcome to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. Here along with...
I'll get out of the way, go. I'm Dave Binkley from Weirdness, Really Bad Movie, and Spaceship One. And we are here along with...
Greetings and felicitations. It's CW. Yes, goat. Go outside and do something useful with yourself. Yeah. And here...
Is it a nanny goat or a billy goat? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. Which one can you milk?
It's a...
Nanny goat. Nanny goat.
Oh, then this is a billy goat.
Did they... Should we have that long talk with you, Dave?
Yeah.
Well, I don't usually turn the goat upside down to look.
Boy, will the after-hours show be good. Folks, I don't know if you're aware, live listeners, but if you go back and listen in the archives, sometimes there's as much as 45 to minutes of us talking about different things. And we're going to have an education with Dave tonight after a regular show.
Yes, we'll go to the library and get the special books and everything.
I can't wait to graduate.
We may run a full 2 hours today because we got a whole lot of material. There's interview material with Ray Bradbury as we slap more icing on his birthday cake with four
right.
more tales and, again, more interview material as well. We get to hear Ray himself talking to us.
At least four or five other parts of the Bradbury on Bradbury.
Yep.
So, plus a commercial he did with Stan Freberg. We have that in the mix as well.
Yeah, which yesterday I was telling Dave before we started, I could have sworn, I thought, Dave made this. How clever. He's doing his impression of Ray Bradbury and... this is his style of humor. And then all of a sudden I hear Stan Freberg's voice. And I'm like, what? Wait, what? I kid you not. I think you're channeling Ray Bradbury, Dave. I think you are. Or maybe he was channeling you. I don't know.
It could be. Could be, you know.
Could be.
He was telling me this is the way it should be, Dave. You know,
switching channels, flipping channels.
There you go. Now, one of our stories tonight we have heard before, but this is a different version.
Right, yeah. We got it from Suspense originally, and this is from Dimension X.
Dimension X, 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 X.
Ooh,
yep.
X, 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 X.
Well, no, it's not dirty. But...
I was going to say, any more X's there, and we can't afford to get married anymore with all those X's around.
Unless you put all those X's on a jug and then drink up, kids.
Talk about alimony. Woo.
Yeah.
Yep, you'll be right up there with...
I think you cut out for just a second there, CW.
Wasn't sure whether it was her or me.
Uh-oh, sorry.
That's okay.
May have been both.
Yeah. Anywho.
So, yeah, we've got that and another story, which a 1950s movie was based on. We have that tonight. And but anything from Ray Bradbury is just great to hear. You know, it's just such a storyteller.
Well, I love his voice. I started watching the Ray Bradbury theaters. They're running them on one of the Pluto channels. And they're fun to watch.
Yeah, I have the entire set on DVD myself. And,
good stuff.
The entire series.
To have.
And it is good stuff. It really is.
Wow.
Many are retellings of these radio programs, which, of course, were often taken from his short stories.
Right, yeah. And what's funny is I found that one of the things it would do that one of the short stories is actually based on a movie script he wrote, which nobody produced. So he turned it into a short story like 3 or 4 years later, and sold that, and then came back later as a movie. So, but we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yep.
What comes around goes around, you know.
Yep. And with four stories tonight, where shall we start?
I don't know. What do you say, CW? Where would you like to start today?
Oh, let's start with X Marks the Spot, Dimension XXX.
Okay, we can do that.
Let's. And
fabulous.
Our first story is called There Will Come Soft Rain.
Yes. Let me tell you a story. The first time I heard this was on a record at the library, and it was something that my brother and I would get out once every 2 or 3 months and listen to it again. And it was read with just one voice by the one and only Burgess Meredith.
Ah, that's got to be good.
But that's what we have here. And
yeah.
This particular episode is from March, April, June 17th of 1950 and nothing. 1950.
Ooh. 1950.
Adventures in time and space. Told in future tense. Dimension. Can you predict the future? Can you tell what will come in 100 years? Or in 10? Or in the next minute? Tonight we present two ventures into the unknown. Two fantasies of the future, chosen from the works of one of our most brilliant young science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury. First, his story entitled, There Will Come Soft Rains. The house was a good house, planned and built to be lived in the year 1980. The real estate agent had told them all about it.
Now, this is the bedroom. Of course, it contains all the latest devices, self-warming blankets, and there's a brand new feature, beds which make themselves. Now, if you'll just step this way through the library, we can see the latest in talking book recorders, self-building fireplace, self-cleaning robot dust disposal. Oh, these little mouse-like things come out of the wall and take away all the dirt. Now, over this way. There's a complete robot kitchen, of course. Just set the menu for the week and the stove does the rest. Then there's the automatic hydroponic garden, self-sprinkling fire protection. See, the house is fully automatic. Well, you could go away for a year and it would run itself.
And so the family took the house, the man and the woman and the two children, a boy and a girl, and they lived contentedly, enjoying music and poetry and the rich, warm things in life. And the house fed them and slept them and entertained them. It made a good life for them. Until one day, there were 10,000 explosions, and the world shook, and red fire and ashes and radioactivity fell from the sky. The happy time was over.
Tick-tock, 7 o'clock, time to rise, open your eyes, tick-tock. 7 o'clock, time to rise, open your eyes.
But the house lay empty. The clock talked to the empty morning. In the kitchen, the stove sighed and ejected from its warm interior 8 eggs, sunny side up, 12 bacon slices, 2 coffees, and 2 cups of hot cocoa.
7, 9, breakfast time, come and dine, 7, 9.
Today is April 28th, 1985. today, remember, is Mr. Featherstone's birthday. Insurance, gas, atom heat, and electricity bills are due.
In the walls, relays clicked. Memory tapes glided under electric eyes. Recorded voices moved beneath steel needles.
It's run, run, run. Off to school, off to work. Run, run, tick, tock. 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock.
But no door slammed. No carpet took the quick tread of rubber heels. At 8:30, the eggs began to shrivel. An aluminum wedge scraped them into the sink.
9:15, time to clean. 9:15, time to clean.
Out of the wall, hundreds of tiny mechanical mice darted. The rooms were a crawl with small cleaning animals, all rubber and metal. They sucked up the hidden dust and dirt and popped back into their burrows. At 10 o'clock, the sun came out from behind the rain. The house stood alone on a street where all the other houses were rubble and ashes. At night, the ruined town gave off a radioactive glow which could be seen for miles. At 10:15, the garden sprinkler filled the soft morning air with golden fountains. The water tinkled over the charred west side of the house, the side which had been facing the blast. It was black, except in five places. One of the five places was a silhouette of a man mowing a lawn, just as he'd been the instant the radioactivity burned his image into the side of the house. Over there, a woman bent to pick flowers. Still further over, their images burned into the wood, where a small boy, hands flung into the air, higher up the image of a thrown ball, and opposite, a girl, her hands raised to catch a ball, which never came down. Five people. Five spots of paint. On the front porch, the dog whined and shivered. The front door recognized the dog's voice and opened. The dog padded in wearily, thin to the bone, covered with sores. It ran to the kitchen and pawed the kitchen door wildly. Behind the door, the stove was making pancakes, which filled the house with their odor, as prescribed by the automatic preset menu selector. The dog frogged, ran insanely, spun in a circle, biting its tail, and died.
1 o'clock, 1 o'clock.
Delicately sensing decay, the regiments of mice hummed out of the walls, soft as blown leaves, their electric eyes glowing.
1:15.
The dog was gone.
2:15.
Bridge tables unfolded from the walls of the patio. Playing cards fluttered onto pads. Martinis appeared on an oaken bench. But the tables were silent, the cards untouched.
5 o'clock. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
Dinner was made, ignored, flushed away. Dishes were washed. In the study, the tobacco stand produced a cigar with half an inch of gray ash upon it, smoking, waiting, waiting. The hearth fire bloomed out of nothing.
9 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
The beds began to warm their hidden circuits, and the phonograph spoke from beside the fireplace.
Mrs. McClelland, what poem would you like to hear this evening? Mr. McClelland? Since you express no preference, I shall select at random from among your favorites. Sarah Teasdale, There Will Come Soft Rains.
There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound, and frogs in the pools singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire, and not one will know of war. Not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone.
The phonograph finished the poem. The empty chairs faced each other between the silent walls. At 10 o'clock that evening, the house began to die. The wind blew the bough of a falling tree into the kitchen window, smashing it. A bottle of cleaning fluid crashed on the stove. Water pumps shot down from the ceiling. But the solvent spread under the doors, making fire as it went. Other voices in other rooms taking up the alarm. The windows broke with the heat, and the wind blew in to help the fire. The fire crackled upstairs at paintings, lay hungrily on the beds, devoured the rooms. The house began to shudder. The bared skeleton began to cringe in the heat. The wires revealed as if a surgeon had torn the skin off. Voices screamed in every room. Windows snapped open and shut like undecided mouths. Thousand things were happening at once, like the interior of a clock shop at midnight. All the clocks were striking, making a merry-go-round of squeaking, whispering, and rushing. In the kitchen, the stove hissing hysterically was making breakfast at a psychopathic rate. 10 dozen pancakes, 6 dozen loaves of toast. Then, there was silence. The film spools were burned out, the wires withered, and the circuits cracked. Then the house began to breathe its last. The beams began to give at the foundations. Long cracks appeared in the concrete. The seams were burst from the heat. And finally, with a huge rumble, it crashed into dust and rubble. Shone faintly in the east. In the ruins of the house, only one wall remained standing. And within the wall, even as the sun rose to shine upon the burning rubble, a voice spoke again and again and again.
No one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly, and spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone. That we were gone. That we were gone. That we were gone.
Today is April 29th, 1985.
Whoa, I love a cheerful story with a happy ending.
Oh, yes.
Well, it is so interesting. It even has a darker feeling when Burgess Meredith does it. We'll have to find that and pull that one of these times. It just, he did, one side was this story. The other side was his reading of The Marionettes Incorporated.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I've heard a few versions of that one. And the, Ray Bradbury TV show.
Yes.
That's cool. Yeah. So usually you can't, but sometimes you can tell it was made in New Zealand.
Oh, okay. Is that where it was from?
Yeah. It was filmed in New Zealand. Yes.
The poem by Sarah Teasdale, who is a real person, or was a real person, There Will Come Soft Rains. She passed away, I believe, in 1933. Very, pretty prolific sort of poet. That particular poem is also for you gamers out there in Fallout game number 3, alongside Mr. Bradbury's short story.
You're cutting in and out again, CW.
I'm phasing in and phasing out.
A little bit.
Yep, you're back in.
Okay,
you're back
sorry.
in.
Okay, I'm back in. And the game is called Fallout 3. Am I on?
Okay.
Yeah, you're on. Fallout 3.
Yes, you are. Fallout 3.
Yeah, Fallout 3. Yeah, and there is a robot that survives the nuclear fallout reciting said poem.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the nuclear apocalypse.
Robot. Robots should be trained in poetry. Robots should
Absolutely.
Be trained in poetry.
And here's
Absolutely.
Something I've noticed. All of the gadgets that Mr. Bradbury came up with, it sounds like he invented the Roomba.
Possibly.
Of course, their gadgets are cleaning everything, but who has to clean the gadgets? The two-legged schmucks who cash out their money to buy them, meaning us.
Yes. Two-legged schmucks. I've often thought of the human race as a two-legged schmuck.
I've worked for a few of those.
Yes. Hey, I resent that.
I said four, not with. Four, not with.
Oh, all right. Yeah, there's a difference.
there's a big difference.
Big difference.
The one you have to say yes, sir, to.
Yeah. On occasion.
Oh.
Yes.
When called for.
On the odd occasion.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very startling poem. Very startling.
It's
He was talking about last night. We'll have some more of him describing his writing, but he was talking about last night how much he loved just about every kind of writing, from Shakespeare to poems to everything, and how he wrote and included so much of his so much of these things and references from all these great writers and such into his stories, as he did here in this
one. Why don't we share one of those now?
Why don't we share one of those now?
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of Ray Bradbury on Ray Bradbury.
Well, that brings to mind your story, There Was an Old Woman, and your theme of encountering death and facing death, and that seems to also reoccur in Kaleidoscope.
Yeah, I think we're all working. A lot of people don't like to talk about it, but I think you have to be very honest that we're competing all the time with time. Time is running out. And I sensed this when I was very young, that I was in a competition with death. I had to get my work done. And every time I put a new short story in the mail, especially a novel, but what a triumph that is, because you really went up, huh? You say, okay, death, I've won this time. And you're not going to win forever. And so, and as you get even older, it's even more clear that your time is running out. So I've been finishing a new novel after 10 years' work during the last few months. And I always feel I'm fighting against that thing. And just so much time is allotted to me. And I'm very privileged to have been able to live this long and write so much. But I've got a huge cargo to leave behind me, huh? And I'm so proud of that. I'm so happy that I did it. And I cannot comprehend people who don't want to leave something behind.
There's a quote on the back of some of your books by the New York Times, which calls you the world's greatest living science fiction writer. Is that how you'd like to be remembered by future generations?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I never did see that quote, and I often wondered where it came from. No, I would like to be known as a magician, a magician of ideas, and when people spoke of me, they would speak of that, of their favorite magician, huh, who was able to do things that no one else could do. I could work illusions. I could make you believe. I mean, in listening to some of these radio shows that you've done, well, if you start tearing them apart, they're unbelievable. You know, really, I have situations on Mars where there's no atmosphere. Now, if you look at it scientifically, come on, dark day, we're in golden night, simply doesn't work because there's no atmosphere there, and they couldn't be running around that way.
Uh-huh.
And a man couldn't build a rocket ship. But then if you relax and say, what I was doing was a metaphor, huh? And you go with a metaphor. You say, okay, this guy's building a rock in his backyard. can't be done, but since he's doing it, Brad Murray makes me believe it. Well, I'll go with him. He's a nice guy. And you go with a metaphor, finally. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. I wouldn't mind being a Martian myself and waking up some morning and looking in the mirror, and there are the golden eyes, and I know the change has begun. Huh?
Ray, of all the books and stories and poems you've ever written, do you have a favorite?
Oh, so many. You know, but one that I'm, the older I get and the more junk comes on TV, like The Day After a couple of months ago, you know, about the Atom War and the destruction of the world, all that junk, and which I refused to watch, you know, because I could see it coming. I knew it would be now. And we had 48 hours of talk before, then added 48 hours more of banal talk after. And I remembered back to my story, There Will Come Soft Rains, which said, told the same story, but told it in 3 pages, and it was dramatized on radio 34 years ago, and I think it took about 12 minutes, maybe 14. And it said more in 14 minutes than this big, overblown 2-hour show, because what it did was simply take all the people away and show you a house that went on talking to itself and performing and reading poetry and entertaining and lighting cigars and making dinner and cleaning the dishes and putting out the cards and watering the lawn and putting the people to sleep even though they weren't there. And finally the house burns up and the house tries to save itself. And the next morning there's nothing left of the house except one big computer panel with some tapes in it playing the poetry and reciting on and on through all the dawns to come. So the house has its own life, and the house is the metaphor for the family. And it tells you more about nuclear war, huh, in a short compact than all the big pieces of nonsense, I think.
Ray, one of the things you've been able to do very successfully is take everyday, ordinary people and place them in fantastic and sometimes futuristic settings. How did you become a science fiction writer?
I blundered into science fiction through doing it all wrong for a while. I think we all blunder into certain kinds of writing and do it wrong because we're busy imitating other people. We have heroes like H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, or a lot of my science fiction friends, Robert Heinlein and Lee Brackett and others that I knew back when I was 18, 19, 20 years old. So you're so busy imitating them, you're doing everything wrong. At the same time, I blundered into the weird tale and began to dredge up out of my subconscious some very personal remembrance of times in my childhood, and stumbled onto a short story like The Lake, which was a real incident out of the time when I was around 8 or 9. And all of a sudden, in the middle of that story, I began to cry, and I knew I was doing something good. I stumbled on something. And as time passes, you say, hey, why don't I take that personal approach that I'm using in the weird tale, things out of my past, ghosts of the past that I'm using, and apply that over in the science fiction field? Because I'm trying to do all these things like imitating John Carter or Lee Brackett, her Stark stories about Mars. And it just wasn't working, you know, you can't imitate. So I wrote a short story about two boys who wanted to be rocket pilots. And I think it was called The King of the Gray Spaces. And that was rejected by every magazine in the field because it just wasn't science fiction. Just a story of two boys who wanted to be rocket pilots. And finally appeared, I believe, in Famous Fantastic Mysteries when I was around 24. And that was a changeover. I realized that I had to write about people, not symbols of people, but real people, and put them in these fantastic situations. And then everything would be believable, because these are just ordinary folks, huh?
Well, the way he says that, when he's driving home a point.
Yep, yep.
Or A.
Very interesting. And very
humble.
Much that's what Rod Serling did a lot, too, was by putting ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And Ray did that to perfection.
Yeah.
He did.
His characters were very believable. They were,
well, like he said, that's relatable. Exactly what he said. They made them believable. That's what makes his stories work.
Very relatable people, too.
Most assuredly. And the thing I like about him is when the interviewer mentioned specifically what made you a quote-unquote science fiction writer, he didn't balk at the title. He embraced it because there have been other writers who, when they're categorized, they really get huffy-puffy about it. Example, Harlan Ellison. He stomped off from an interview when someone referred to him as a science fiction writer. Duh.
How dare they? How dare they express their adoration in a way I did not want.
What nerve, what gall.
I tell you, where are these people coming from? Funny.
But I can't say they're coming from Mars, otherwise that'd be science fiction. So
there you go.
There you are.
So that's not
wonderful
where it's from.
Interview.
It is. We've got more of this stick around. More Bradbury.
More.
But first, let's play the second half of this episode of Dimension X.
Yes. So all you guys can make millions of dollars. All you have to do is create a robot that cleans the Roomba, and you're set. There you go.
There you go.
That cleans the Roomba.
Night.
I like that.
There's moral number one.
There you go. All right.
Good night,
folks.
The
there you are.
Yeah.
Good night, buddy.
Good night.
Feel better, man.
Feel better. Bye. Feel better.
Get well, bro.
All right. Bye-bye.
That, of course, was the one and only lovable Gar V. Ghoul, or Thaddeus.
Yep, he'll be doing a rerun. He'll be doing a rerun tonight because he's not feeling up to par. Migraine's got him knocked in three different stages again, but he'll be there with a brand new version of an old show.
Yep, at 8 Eastern, of course, we'll be still hanging around finishing up with Ray Bradbury, I think, at the pace we're going. Let's you may have heard this story on Eerie House, as Dave mentioned before. We played the suspense version. This one is from Dimension X. Chilling story, especially if you're an adult parent. You'll find out what I mean as we present Dimension X's Zero Hour, originally broadcast way back in.
Still yet, June 17th of 1950 and nothing.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Strange are the uses of providence. Is this how the end will come for mankind, with 10,000 explosions and a flash of radioactive gas? Or will destruction come more subtly, extended to us gently and innocently in, let's say, the hand of a child? Who knows in what manner Zero Hour may arrest the world we know? It was a perfect summer day in the year 1985. The streets were lined with green, peaceful trees. Businessmen sat in their quiet offices, taping their voices or watching televisors. Rockets hovered like darning needles in the blue sky. There was the universal quiet conceit and easiness of men accustomed to peace, quite certain that there would never be war or trouble again. There were no traitors among men, no unhappy ones, no disgruntled ones. The world was upon stable ground. Sunlight illumined the suburbs, and the town drowsed on a tide of warm, sunlit air. On the lawns, the children played, catapulting this way and that across the green grass, shouting at each other, holding hands, flying in circles, climbing trees, and laughing. And in the homes, busy mothers prepared for the evening arrival of their husbands.
Heavens, Meg, what's all the excitement?
We're playing a game, Mommy, the most exciting game ever.
What are you doing in that cabinet?
Playing some tools from Daddy's kit.
Your father may not like...
Oh, I'll take good care of them, Mom, I promise.
Very well. Don't you lose anything.
Oh, thank you, Mom.
You want a glass of milk?
Can't stop now, Mom.
What's the name of the game, Mink?
Invasion.
Invasion. What will they think of next?
Now this, and this, and this, and this. Now put that there, and bring that over here. Oh, no, you ninny. Now get back while I fix this. There, they want it this way, see? Here, just let me fix
me.
Oh, Mink, it's that smarty pants, Joseph Connors. Don't let him play. He's 12 years old.
Don't worry, I won't.
What you playing, Mink?
None of your business, smarty pants.
I want to play.
Can't.
Why not?
You're too old.
Just because you're only 8.
No, you'd only laugh at us and spoil the invasion.
Make him go away, Mink.
Go away? This is my backyard.
Now, who wants to play with you and your old fairies anyway?
They aren't fairies.
Enough to you. I don't want to play anyway.
Good riddance. I'm glad you didn't let him play, Mink.
He'd only laugh. Now, we'd better talk to Drill and get some more instructions, Art. Now, here's your pad and pencil.
Where is Drill? Drill? Hey, Drill. Drill?
Well, he's in the rose bush, I think. I'll talk to him myself, and you write it down the pad.
Okay.
Drill? Drill? Okay. Drill wants you to write down triangle.
What's a triangle?
Never mind. Drill will tell us when he wants us to know. It helps the invasion.
How do you spell it?
Well, I'll ask Drill. Drill, how do you spell...
Here's your mother, looking out the window.
Me?
Yes, Mother?
Who are you talking to?
The rose bush, Mom. Only it's not really a rose bush. That's Drill.
Who's Drill?
He's planning the invasion.
Oh, I see. Well, you better come in and clean up for supper. Your daddy will be home soon.
In just a second, Mom. You got that, Art?
See, now what? 4, 9, 7, and A, and B, and X, and a fork, and some string, and a hexagony, hexagonal, Droopy.
Come on, Nick. Supper's in 10 minutes.
Okay, Mom. Just a minute. I have to tell Drill. I wish we didn't have to eat, though. It holds up the invasion.
Jake, slow down. You'll choke on that soup.
I can't. It's a matter of life and death.
What's a matter of life and death?
The invasion.
What invasion is that?
Oh, just some silly game the children have been playing.
Well, whatever it is, Mink, it'll wait until you've finished your supper, I'm sure.
Oh, I don't want any more.
You've barely touched anything.
Oh, but Drill is waiting for me, Daddy.
Drill? Who's Drill?
He lives in a rose bush in our backyard. Imagination, Henry. Oh,
such nonsense.
I've got to run now.
You'll sit through dessert, young lady.
Oh, gee, Daddy.
And while you're at it, tell me more about this new game.
It's Martians invading Earth, Daddy.
What?
Well, not exactly Martians, Daddy. They're from... Well, gee, I don't know. From up.
And from inside that little head of yours.
You're laughing at me. Drill said you would. You'll kill Drill and everybody.
Well, I didn't know you could kill a Martian.
But it's not really a Martian, Mom. Maybe he's from Jupiter or Venus, even.
Imagine.
They couldn't figure out a way to attack the Earth. We are impregnable.
Impregnable, dear.
Well, that's the word Drill said, Well, anyway, that was the word, Mom, the same word. Anyway, so we're helping him.
Now, who's helping who?
Well, the kids are helping the Martians.
Well,
the
fifth column, eh?
Well, Drill says in order to make a good fight, you got to have a new way of surprising the people. That way you win. And he says also you got to have help from your enemy.
Pretty slick, those Martians, using the kids for a fifth column, eh, Mary?
And hiding under rose bushes, too, Henry. Don't forget that.
Well, that's because grown-ups never look under rose bushes. Only kids.
Oh, I see. Well, finish your fruit, darling. You can play for an hour afterward.
Mary.
Oh, it's so nice out, Henry. There's no school tomorrow.
Very well. Till 8 o'clock.
Drill says after the invasion, we can stay up as late as we want. No more bets, either.
Oh, is that so?
We can watch all the grown-up televisor shows.
I don't wonder this invasion has caught on among the kids.
Well, some of the kids are giving us trouble, like Dale Britz and Petey Jarek. They're growing up so they won't believe in the invasion. They make fun. Worse than parents, even. I hate them worst. We'll kill them first.
I hope you're saving your father and me for last.
But Drill says you're dangerous.
What?
But I think they'll let me keep you because I'm helping so much. I'll talk to Drill. Maybe we won't have to kill you.
Mary, I think this nonsense has gone far enough.
Can I go out now, please?
Well, run along, dear.
Don't worry, Dad. I won't let them hurt you.
Mary, I think the child's taking this game entirely too seriously. Invasion.
Now, Henry, you know how Mink is. Besides, all children have their aggressions. Better to get them out in the open, I suppose.
Maybe you're right. I was wondering about bridge with the Jacksons tonight, Mary.
All right. You look tired, dear. Why don't you sit in the relaxer for a while and get a massage? I'll sew for a while until it's time to... Oh, I wanted to call my sister Helen.
Oh, good. Find out when her husband's going to return my golf clubs.
Would you please connect me with Mrs. Helen Rogerson on Channel 7-2Z, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
What is your channel, please?
817X, New Rochelle, New York.
Thank you. Just a moment. Go ahead. You can see your party now.
Hello, Mary. How are things in New York?
Fine, Helen. How are things in Pittsburgh? You look tired.
Oh, I've been having a terrible time with the children.
Sick?
No, just underfoot. They've got a new game that's got me just about crazy. It's called Invasion.
Did you say Invasion?
That's right.
Well, isn't that strange? My Mink is playing it, too.
My boy Tim is all involved with some imaginary fellow named Drill, who's running the Invasion.
Must be a new password. Mink likes him, too.
How do you suppose these games start? My backyard looks like a scrap drive. They've got every conceivable kind of mechanical gadget arranged out there. I talked to Josephine Schiller in Boston, and she says her kids are wild about it, too. It's sweeping the country.
Remember when it was the Roomba?
Please, dear, I'm not that old.
Mommy!
Oh, please, Minky, I'm on the televisor. Come on, see your Aunt Helen.
Hello, Mink.
Hi, Aunt Helen. Look what I've got.
What is it, honey?
Well, it's a yo-yo. Look when I enroll it. See?
Well, Helen, look, it vanished. Where did it go?
Into another dim.
She means dimension. I'll say the darndest thing. My Timmy brought one home, too. I can't figure out how they work. Make it reappear, honey.
There. See, it's easy.
Where'd you get it, dear?
Drill gave it to me, Mom.
Mink?
Bye, Aunt Helen. Gotta run now.
Mink, you come back here. I want to talk to you.
10:00, 5:00.
Mink!
Bye!
Oh, I can't understand it. The child's never been so unruly. Helen... Do you suppose that...
What?
Nothing. Just a wild thought. Say, the reason I called, I want to get that black and white cake recipe. And Henry wants his golf clubs. I don't know what he'll do.
What was that?
I don't know. One of the children must have been hurt. I'll have to run and see. Call me back tonight, will you?
All right, Mary. Bye.
Mink, come here.
Yes, Mom.
What is it? Who screamed?
Peggy Ann.
All right, what happened?
Well, she got scared and went home.
Did you hit her?
No, she just got scared. She's a scared baby anyway. We won't let her play anymore. She's getting too old. Mm.
Now, Mink, tell me why she cried.
No, I can't.
Mink, you'll answer me this instant or come inside. I've had enough of this nonsense.
Gee, I can't quit now, Mom. It's almost 00:00.
Then tell me what frightened Peggy Ann.
Okay, she saw Drill.
Drill?
He almost came through. He was just testing.
Through what?
Well, those pipes and things we set up. She looked into one of the pipes and screamed. I guess she saw Drill.
And no one hit her?
Uh-uh.
Very well, Mink. I'll call Peggy Ann's mother and see how she is. And I'll call you for your bath in half an hour. Your father and I want to go out tonight.
You won't be able to go out, Mom.
Why not?
00:00, 5:00, Mom.
Hello, dear.
Oh, You're home already, Henry?
Yes, I thought I'd relax a little before we went to theater. Where's the little one?
Out back.
Same game?
Same game. They've got a stack of pipes and hammers and spoons a mile high out there.
Children, children, why do we have them?
They are strange little creatures, aren't they? Even Mink, Henry. She's a part of us, and yet what do we really know about how she thinks and feels?
Oh, I didn't mean to start a philosophic discussion.
Kids are such a queer mixture of love and hate, though. Even normal, healthy kids. They need you, and they're dependent on you, and yet they resent that dependence.
You sound like a child psychology course I once took.
I wonder if they ever really forgive the whippings and the commands we have to give them sometimes. I wonder if we ever forgot them when we were children.
Look, I'd like to discuss this with you, dear, but we do have a theater date, and it's almost 5 o'clock now. What's happened to the kids? They're so quiet. When children are quiet, you know there's some mischief. What's that sound?
I don't know.
Those kids aren't playing with anything electrical, are they?
I'm sure they are. At least
I just the same. I'd better go out.
Henry,
see.
Tell them to put off the invasion.
What? Mary, don't get upset. It's just a game. Good Lord, what's that? Look out the window, Mary. What is it? Where are the children? Mary, why are you shaking? What did you see?
Henry, quick, up to the attic.
They aren't in the attic.
Yes, yes, the attic. Quick.
Mary, come back here. Mary! Mary, don't go up. They aren't up there. Mary, you out of your mind? There's no one up here.
Quick, shut the door.
There's nothing up here. What is wrong with you? Mary, come to your senses.
Henry.
What are you talking about?
I saw it through the window, Henry. It was horrible.
What?
It is an invasion.
For heaven's sake, let's get down out of this attic and talk this over sensibly. I want to find out if Mink is all right.
She's all right. I saw her. She was leading them around the corner of the house.
Leading who? The kids? Nothing.
Oh, listen.
Huh?
The front door. They're coming.
Good Lord, those kids sound like 50 men with boots on.
No, not men. Oh,
huh?
Please, God, don't let them find us. Don't let them, please, God.
I don't understand. Who's there? I demand that you answer me!
They're coming! The whole house is shaking!
Who? Who's there?
Please, be quiet, Henry. Might go away. Henry? Henry?
Mom? Dad? Are you in the attic?
Henry, listen.
It's Mink. Mink. You've got to save her.
Henry, you don't understand. She's leading them.
What?
She's leading them. She's on their side. Oh, please, God, forgive them.
The children on their side?
Oh, she told us, but we wouldn't believe her. Henry, they're coming out!
Mom? Dad, we know you're in there. Well, I guess you better melt the lock,
Trip. Henry, the lock! It's melted! The door! Oh, dear God!
Mom? Dad? Oh, I see you now. Peek-a-boo!
I've just heard another adventure into the unknown world of the future, the world of Dimension X. Next week,
Destination Moon, a preview of the movie which is soon to have its world premiere in New York, telling the Robert Heinlein story of man's first trip to the moon.
Tonight's adventures in Dimension X, There Will Come Soft Rains, and Zero Hour were written by Ray Bradbury and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the first story as narrator was your host, Norman Rose. The leading players in Zero Hour were Denise Alexander as Mink and Rita Lynn as the mother, Roger DeCoven as the father. Music by Albert Berman. Engineer Don Abbott. Dimension X is produced by Van Woodward and directed by Edward King. Robert Warren speaking.
Corvo, the friendly duo.
Programs, get your programs here. For a new thrill in detective listening, join the saint tomorrow as he reaps a harvest of criminals in a thrilling adventure with the underworld. Make the saint a Sunday listening habit and keep tuned thereafter for adventures of the greatest detective of them all, Sam Spade. Tomorrow, hear High Adventure, now Truth or Consequences on NBC.
Eerie House Radio cautiously presents a garrulous moral of the story. If you think that kids could be, like, a good idea to be in charge of the world, ought to reread Lord of the Flies. There we go. Yes. That's my thoughts on empowering children, I'll tell you.
Yeah, you got to be careful of that. Got to be careful of that.
Yeah.
Hey, we've hit the halfway point. It would be a nice little spot to throw in that Stan Freberg, Ray Bradbury commercial there, Dale.
Oh, you're going to love this, CW. Check this out.
Well, that's the other one, Dale.
You're wondering what's happening to your radio. It's developing.
The other one?
Yeah.
The 59-second one? All right. Yeah,
yep. One. That's a commercial.
Hey, you know what's really good? It's when you turn up the volume and people can hear it. I'll try that.
You are looking at Mr. Ray Bradbury, distinguished science fiction author of Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles, who has said, by the year 2001, man will travel about in pneumatic people tubes, his television wall to wall, and most incredible of all, his SunSweet pitted prunes carried in tiny mini packs.
Hold it! What's going on here?
Pardon me?
I never mentioned prunes in any of my stories.
Oh, you didn't?
No, never. I'm sorry to be so candid.
No, they're not candid, but pretty sweet all the same. The prune of tomorrow, available now for school lunches, executive snacks, the world's first tiny package of five pitted prunes.
They're still rather badly wrinkled, though.
SunSweet's wrinkle technicians will one day conquer that, too. SunSweet marches on.
I never mentioned prunes in any of my stories. What are these people trying to pull?
Oh, my gosh, that is classic. That is so classic.
It is epic.
They had a nice friendship. They had a nice friendship going, Ray Bradbury and Stan Freberg as well. Can you imagine having a more fun friend than Stan Freberg?
Oh, geez.
That is incredible.
Frighteningly.
Yep.
Again, I think we're losing you here, CW.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Periodically.
You're back.
You're back.
You're back.
Periodically pinging out on us. Ping, ping, ping.
Darn that ping, ping, ping. Anyway, it was incredible.
Ping.
Wonderful.
That's right. You should save the pings for Ricochet Rabbit.
Yeah, indeed. Well, time for some stories by Bradbury.
Or, just before we get into that, how much time we got? We got time.
We got time.
I pulled up a bit on the five best Ray Bradbury stories turned into movies. Best movies based on Ray Bradbury stories. Starting off with number five, It Came from Outer Space in 1953.
Yep.
Classic black and white 50s movie. Unique among the 50s era movies about aliens, as Ray Bradbury would later say, I wanted to treat the invaders as beings who were not dangerous. And that was very unusual.
True.
Number four is The Halloween Tree from 1933. I'm sorry, 1993.
The Halloween Tree
is an animated fantasy direct-to-TV movie released in 1993 by Hanna-Barbera. It's based on Bradbury's novel, and at first glance, it seems like a standard children's movie about Halloween, but the script is, unsurprisingly, very well done. Went on to earn Bradbury an Emmy for his screenplay adaptation, and Bradbury also plays the narrator of this movie, alongside the wonderful Leonard Nimoy. So that's something I need to look up. Looks like fun.
That looks like a lot
number
of
fun. Number three. Any guesses?
Beast from 20,000
Planets. Number three is Something Wicked This Way Comes from 1983. Yeah, surprisingly, a Walt Disney production film, as Disney wanted to branch out from the perception of animated and family-friendly studio. And his stark fantasy story written by Ray Bradbury was a perfect way to do that. Bradbury originally wrote it as a screenplay in 1958. When the movie never came about, he adapted it into a novel published in 1962. The story centers around two boys who visit the mysterious carnival that comes to their small town, and they get pulled into the well of dark magic and demonic powers. And so it went from a screenplay that never got done into a novel, which did get done, and back into a screenplay, which Disney produced. Number two, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms from 1953.
Got it.
Bradbury's influence and atmosphere certainly lends itself to the 50s decade, perhaps more than any other. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms might be the most influential of his contributions in that era. Released in 53, like other adaption on the list, It Came from Outer Space, the black and white film was direct inspiration for Godzilla and many other giant monster movies. It was the first movie to use the atomic energy in the plot of the monster conception. And based on the 1951 Bradbury story, The Foghorn, which we're about to hear. And the number one movie. Come on, guys. Number one movie.
Illustrated Man.
Adaption.
Fahrenheit 451.
Martian Chronicles. Fahrenheit
451. Yeah. Yep. From 1966. Based on Bradbury's most famous book of the same name, written in 1953. Dystopian novel about a fireman that sets fires instead of putting them out. With the famous opening line, it was a pleasure to burn. So there you go. At least in this particular writer's top five Bradbury stories movies that were made from a Bradbury story.
And with respect to Fahrenheit 451, another Ray Bradbury quote is, the only crime greater than burning books is not reading them.
Ooh.
Ooh, hear, hear.
Well said, great Ray. All right, let's move on and let's pick up another story here. It's time for the Foghorn, isn't it?
Was that the second story? I think that was the second story. But
you're right.
It doesn't matter. You can put in whatever order you wish.
All right, let's go with number one, All in a Summer Day. Stories by Bradbury. And
from the BBC... This comes to us from October 8th, I'm sorry. Yes, October 8th. Wait a second. Try August 30th of 20 and 10. Here we go.
Oh. How modern.
Very modern.
Again, works so much better when you pull the volume up. Somebody kick me!
All Summer in a Day by Ray Bradbury. Ready? Ready? Now? Soon? Do the scientists really know? Will it happen today? Will it? Look, look. See for yourself. The children pressed to each other like so many roses, so many weeds, intermixed, peering out for a look at the hidden sun. It rained. It had been raining for 7 years, thousands upon thousands of days, compounded and filled from one end to the other with rain, with the drum and gush of water, with the sweet crystal fall of showers, and the concussion of storms so heavy they were tidal waves come over the islands. 1,000 forests had been crushed under the rain and grown up 1,000 times to be crushed again. And this was the way life was forever on the planet Venus, and this was the schoolroom of the children of the rocket men and women who had come to a raining world to set up civilization and live out their lives. It's stopping! It's stopping! Yes! Yes! Margot stood apart from them, from these children who could never remember a time when there wasn't rain and rain and rain. They were all 9 years old, and if there had been a day, 7 years ago, when the sun came out for an hour and showed its face to the stunned world, they could not recall. Sometimes at night she heard them stir in remembrance, and she knew they were dreaming and remembering gold or a yellow crayon or a coin large enough to buy the world with. She knew they thought they remembered a warmness, like a blushing in the face, in the body, in the arms and legs and trembling hands. But then they always awoke to the tatting drum, the endless shaking down of clear bead necklaces upon the roof, the walk, the gardens, the forests, and their dreams were gone. All day yesterday they had read in class about the sun, about how like a lemon it was, and how hot. And they had written small stories or essays or poems about it. I think the sun is a flower that blooms for just 1 hour. That was Margot's poem, read in a quiet voice in the still classroom while the rain was falling outside.
Ah, oh, you didn't write that, protested one of the boys.
I did, said Margot. I did. William, said the teacher. But that was yesterday. Now the rain was slackening, and the children were crushed in the great thick windows.
Where's teacher? She'll be back. She'd better hurry, we'll miss it.
They turned on themselves like a feverish wheel, all tumbling spokes. Margot stood alone. She was a very frail girl, who looked as if she had been lost in the rain for years, and the rain had washed out the blue from her eyes and the red from her mouth and the yellow from her hair. She was an old photograph, dusted from an album, whitened away, and if she spoke at all, her voice would be a ghost. Now she stood, separate, staring at the rain and the loud, wet world beyond the huge glass.
"What are you looking at?" said William.
Margot said nothing.
"Speak when you're spoken to."
He gave her a shove, but she did not move. Rather, she let herself be moved only by him and nothing else. They edged away from her. They would not look at her. She felt them go away. And this was because she would play no games with them in the echoing tunnels of the underground city. If they tagged her and ran, she stood blinking after them and did not follow. When the class sang songs about happiness and life and games, her lips barely moved. Only when they sang about the sun and the summer did her lips move as she watched the drenched windows. And then, of course,
the biggest crime of all was that she had come here only 5 years ago from Earth, and she remembered the sun, and the way the sun was and the sky was when she was 4 in Ohio. And they had been on Venus all their lives, and they had been only 2 years old when last the sun came out, and had long since forgotten the color and heat of it and the way it really was. But Margot remembered. "It's like a penny," she said once, eyes closed. "No, it's not," the children cried. "It's like a fire," she said, "in the stove." "You're lying. You don't remember," cried the children. But she remembered and stood quietly apart from all of them and watched the patterning windows. And once, a month ago, she had refused to shower in the school shower rooms, had clutched her hands to her ears and over her head, screaming, "The water mustn't touch her head." So after that, dimly, dimly, she sensed it. She was different, and they knew her difference and kept away. There was talk that her father and mother were taking her back to Earth next year. It seemed vital to her that they do so, though it would mean the loss of thousands of dollars to her family. And so the children hated her for all these reasons of big and little consequence. They hated her pale snow face, her waiting silence, her thinness, and her possible future. "Get away!" The boy gave her another push. "What are you waiting for?" Then, for the first time, she turned and looked at him. And what she was waiting for was in her eyes. "Well, don't wait around here," cried the boy savagely. "You won't see nothing." Her lips moved. "Nothing," he cried. "It was all a joke, wasn't it?" He turned to the other children. "Nothing's happening today, is it?" They all blinked at him and then, understanding, laughed and shook their heads. "Nothing, nothing." "Oh," Margot whispered, her eyes helpless. "But this is the day the scientists predict. They say they know. The sun..." "All a joke," said the boy and seized her roughly. "Hey, everyone, let's put her in the closet before teacher comes." "No," said Margot, falling back. They surged about her, caught her up and bore her, protesting, and then pleading, and then crying, back into a tunnel, a room, a closet, where they slammed and locked the door. They stood looking at the door and saw it tremble from her beating and throwing herself against it. They heard her muffled cries. Then, smiling, they turned and went out and back down the tunnel just as the teacher arrived. "Ready, children?" She glanced at her watch. "Yes," said everyone. "Are we all here?" "Yes." The rain slackened still more. They crowded to the huge door. The rain stopped. The silence was so immense and unbelievable that you felt your ears had been stuffed or you had lost your hearing altogether. The children put their hands to their ears. They stood apart. The door slid back, and the smell of the silent, waiting world came into them. The sun came out. It was the color of flaming bronze, and it was very large, and the sky around it was a blazing blue tile color, and the jungle burned with sunlight as the children, released from their spell, rushed out, yelling, into the springtime. "Now don't go too far," called the teacher after them. "You've only 2 hours, you know. You wouldn't want to get caught out." But they were running and turning their faces up to the sky and feeling the sun on their cheeks like a warm iron. "Oh, it's better than the sun lamps, isn't it? Much, much better." They stopped running and stood in the great jungle that covered Venus, that grew and never stopped growing, tumultuously, even as you watched it. It was a nest of octopi, clustering up great arms of flesh-like weed, wavering, flowering in this brief spring. It was the color of rubber and ash, this jungle, from the many years without sun. It was the color of stones and white cheeses and ink, and it was the color of the moon. The children lay out,
laughing on the jungle mattress, and heard it sigh and squeak under them, resilient and alive. They ran among the trees, they slipped and fell, they pushed each other, they played hide-and-seek and tag, but most of all, they squinted at the sun until tears ran down their faces. They put their hands up to that yellowness and that amazing blueness, and they breathed of the fresh, fresh air and listened to the silence. They looked at everything and savored everything. Then, wildly, like animals escaped from their caves, they ran and ran in shouting circles. They ran for an hour and did not stop running. And then, in the midst of their running, one of the girls wailed. Everyone stopped. "Oh, look, look," she said, trembling. They came slowly to look at her open palm. In the center of it, cupped and huge, was a single raindrop. She began to cry, looking at it. They glanced quietly at the sky. A few cold drops fell on their noses and their cheeks and their mouths. The sun faded behind a stir of mist. A wind blew cool around them. They turned and started to walk back toward the underground house, their hands at their sides, their smiles vanishing away. A boom of thunder startled them, and like leaves before a new hurricane, they tumbled upon each other and ran. Lightning struck 10 miles away, 5 miles away, a mile, a half mile. The sky darkened into midnight in a flash. They stood in the doorway of the underground for a moment until it was raining hard. Then they closed the door and heard the gigantic sound of the rain falling in tons and avalanches everywhere and forever.
Will it be 7 more years?
Yes, 7. Then one of them gave a little cry.
Margot!
What?
She's still in the closet where we locked her.
Margot. They stood as if someone had driven them, like so many stakes, into the floor. They looked at each other, and then looked away. They glanced out at the world that was raining now, and raining steadily. They could not meet each other's glances.
Margot.
One of the girls said,
"Well?"
No one moved.
"Go on,"
whispered the girl. They walked slowly down the hall in the sound of cold rain. They turned through the doorway to the room in the sound of the storm and thunder, lightning on their faces, blue and terrible. They walked over to the closet door slowly and stood by it. Behind the closet door was only silence. They unlocked the door even more slowly and let Margot out. That was All Summer in a Day.
Wow. Boy,
My first experience with this story had to be when I was maybe about 10 or 11 years old. Somebody had put it onto a film. We showed it in our school at the DeWitt Clinton Elementary in New York, and they showed that movie, and I had no idea actually even who Ray Bradbury was at that time. The story always struck with me, and when I heard this come in, I said, "Oh, wow." So,
understandable. Wow, just, that just gets you.
Yeah, that jumps right at you, man. Quite a writer,
yep,
is the Ray Man. Have another.
I'm glad you called him a writer. Yep, yep. I was going to say, I'm glad you write. You called him a writer, and not a science fiction writer. It was New York Times that once called the writer most responsible for bringing modern science fiction into the literary mainstream. Famous creators from Steven Spielberg to Germain to Stephen King himself have cited Bradbury as a great influence on their work. He has everything from a type of nebula award to a crater on the moon named after him. He just rejected the label of science fiction writer, and perhaps the label Midwest Surrealist, as he once called, fits more aptly.
A really neat guy. Let's hear from him before we get on to the foghorn.
Yes, let's do that. Let's do that.
Please do.
We've got a little more Bradbury on Bradbury.
You already mentioned some of the stories that you wrote were created from lists of words, word association stories. Did you write these just for fun, or is there really some message there you're trying to give us?
Everything's fun for me. If it isn't fun, I don't want to do it. And it may very well be that inadvertently or indirectly, I am doing a teaching lesson, I find out later. But if the fun isn't there, then the lesson isn't worth it. Anyone that sets out to write a socially important novel is going to be a bore. I can't think of, and if you can think of one, I'd be willing to agree with you. I can't think of any socially significant novels out of the 30s written to change our minds about the world that are worth a damn today. The only novel I can think of that has a slight tinge of that is Grapes of Wrath, but that to me is a novel about a family and a man and a place and a movement, and it's only indirectly a semi-political or social tract. If Steinbeck had applied some of his earlier techniques to that novel, he would have ruined it. He was much more socially conscious a few books before that, and they don't read as well as a result. You cannot go out to cure the world.
And yet you wrote Fahrenheit 451, which was a very important social
book. But it was an adventure, first of all, and I fell in love with the idea of a fireman who burned books, huh? And that to me was so terrific, it was irresistible. And then once you start talking to Montag and discover he has discovered books and he wants to read them, then I say, well, heck, go read them and I'll follow. So in 9 days, I wrote the novel, and it was a lark.
Are we any closer to George Orwell's concept of 1984 or your concept in Fahrenheit 451?
Well, most of us write novels to prevent futures, not predict them. So I think we're all moral writers of fables. I think Jules Verne was that way. H.G. Wells most certainly was. I think we all want to change the world, and the way to change it is to occasionally scare it and say, if you don't behave, Santa Claus isn't coming, huh? And something's going to happen to you, something terrible. So you scare people with your stories of futures you don't really believe in. You're just a little afraid of. So we're no closer to 1984 now in the United States than we ever were. We're a very healthy, self-aerating, revolutionary, truly revolutionary country.
Are you a moody person? Are there times when you just can't write?
No, I don't allow that to happen. We mustn't. You know, that is that self-pity of the worst sort. You mustn't allow that to happen. If these moods happen, it means something is wrong with the way you're living. Huh? They're a warning. It's like a taste for salt, and you immediately feel you're thirsty, and you could go drink some fresh water. Or something's missing from your diet, and you sense that there's something wrong. So you learn to stop whatever it is you're doing. That's healthy. So you go swim, you go run, you go play badminton, you get on a bicycle, whatever it is to break the mood, to get away from that stupid thing that's going on, and then try to find out why you got in the mood. You know, you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, huh? If I were a teacher and I were moody all the time, I'd suddenly realize, number one, either I hate my students, huh, or I hate what I'm teaching. I've taught it too many years. I've got to shift. I've got to find another subject. I've got to get a new kind of student. I've got to take a sabbatical, whatever it is. Sit down and find out why you're so damn moody. And then do something about it. In the instant, not tomorrow, not next week. There's something if it goes on too long. So I've learned over the years not to put up with this nonsense. And so I rarely have moods that sustain themselves. I simply will not permit. And I go do something totally different. A new piece of work will drag the old piece of work after it. And sometimes you're just tired. You've done a thing too often. I've been on this novel 10 years now. If I'm not careful, it drags me down. I don't allow that. I go do a new short story. The energy I borrow from that, I go back to the novel, and boom, everything comes to focus again. Huh? So you borrow energy. Find ways of borrowing energy. And so many new things to do. So many films you haven't seen yet, or old films you've been promising yourself to see again, or old radio shows you haven't heard since you were a kid. And you play those, oh, yes, that's where I started. Huh? That's where I started. That's who I was. So all these ways of revivifying yourself.
If I could change the subject just a bit. It occurs to me you're the only person who's ever written a novel about Halloween.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? There have been a few other technical books. I got curious about this about 15 years or so ago. I got to know Chuck Jones, the animator cartoonist, and loved him so much, became a very good friend of his. And we said, let's do an animated cartoon together. What shall we do? And Chuck says, well, let's do a film on Halloween. You know, you got any ideas for Halloween? Because we both had, even though we liked Peanuts and we loved Charles Schulz, we didn't like The Great Pumpkin, huh? Because the whole thing turns out to be a fraud. The Great Pumpkin never shows, you know. Because I'm sorry, you cannot do that to us. You cannot treat us children that way. Because if you tell us the Great Pumpkin is going to come, he's got to show one way or the other. So I said, I'm going to do the whole thing over and make the Great Pumpkin show up. So I said to Chuck, I've got a painting I want to show you that I'd done years before called The Halloween Tree. And I have it in my office, a huge thing. It's a big tree filled with pumpkins, and there's a body lying out under the tree made of leaves, an autumn person underneath the tree. And Chuck looked at that and said, well, that's the plot for the animated film. Let's put you to work on it, and you research Halloween. Let's do an adventure, a journey into Halloween. So then I created Mr. Monstrous and took all these kids back on a journey through death. And when I was done with it, and Chuck said, great, we'll get to work on this and do a 90-minute animated cartoon. MGM shut down its animation unit, threw us out of the studio, and we were on the streets with nowhere to go. So I says, to heck with it. I loved all the research I'd done, and I loved the story. So I wrote it into a novel, and when I was all done, I realized I had written the first novel, really, about death for children, the first real analysis of Halloween ever seriously to be undertaken. And in a way, it's an homage to Charlie Dickens. It is first cousin to The Christmas Carol. I knew when I was writing it, I was setting out to do a kind of mirror, a dark mirror reflection of The Christmas Carol. Not the same sort of story at all, but the spirit of adventure that's in Dickens to me, the young thing in him, the actor, his love of atmosphere, his love of ghosts, his love of that holiday when all the ghosts come back, and that mixture of Christmas that he knew so well.
Now that is a man after my own spirit.
Yes.
You know, the most profound thing I heard him say in there, that we write to prevent the future, not to predict it. What an amazing thought there.
Yeah. He
very profound.
He was very self-aware in a very, very strong way. Very self-aware guy.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yep.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
We got one more story to go there, Dale.
Indeed. It's the second part of Stories by Ray Bradbury. And this one, of course, is the inspiration for Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, a story that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post called The Foghorn. And let's just share that broadcast date one more time.
That broadcast date one more time is August the 30th of 2010.
That's right. Write it down. There's going to be a test.
The Foghorn by Ray Bradbury. Out there in the cold water, far from land, we waited every night for the coming of the fog, and it came, and we oiled the brass machinery and lit the fog light up in the stone tower. Feeling like two birds in the gray sky, McDonn and I sent the light touching out, red, then white, then red again, to eye the lonely ships. And if they did not see our light, then there was always our voice, the great deep cry of our foghorn shuddering through the rags of mist to startle the gulls away like decks of scattered cards and make the waves turn high and foam. "It's a lonely life, but you're used to it now, aren't you?" asked McDonn. "Yes," I said. "You're a good talker, thank the Lord." "Well, it's your turn on land tomorrow," he said, smiling, "to dance the ladies and drink gin." "What do you think, McDonn, when I leave you out here alone?" "On the mysteries of the sea." McDonn lit his pipe. It was 7:15 of a cold November evening, the heat on, the light switching its tail in 200 directions, the foghorn bumbling in the high throat of the tower. There wasn't a town for 100 miles down the coast, just a road which came lonely through dead country to the sea, with few cars on it, a stretch of 2 miles of cold water out to our rock, and rare few ships. "The mysteries of the sea," said McDonn thoughtfully. "You know the ocean's the biggest damned snowflake ever. It rolls and swells 1,000 shapes and colors, no two alike. Strange. One night, years ago, I was here alone when all of the fish of the sea surfaced out there. Something made them swim in and lie in the bay, sort of trembling and staring up at the tower light going red, white, red, white across them, so I could see their funny eyes. I turned cold. They were like a big peacock's tail moving out there until midnight. Then, without so much as a sound, they slipped away. The million of them was gone. I kind of think maybe, in some sort of way, they came all those miles to worship. Strange. But think how the tower must look to them, standing 70 feet above the water, the god light flashing out from it, and the tower declaring itself with a monster voice. They never came back, those fish. But don't you think for a while they thought they were in the presence?" I shivered. I looked out at the long grey lawn of the sea stretching away into nothing and nowhere. "Oh, the sea's full." McDonn puffed his pipe nervously, blinking. He had been nervous all day and hadn't said why. "Come on, I got something special I've been saving up to tell you." We ascended the 80 steps, talking and taking our time. At the top, McDonn switched off the room lights so there'd be no reflection in the plate glass. The foghorn was blowing steadily, once every 15 seconds. "Sounds like an animal, don't it?" McDonn nodded to himself. "A big, lonely animal, crying in the night, sitting here on the edge of 10 billion years, calling out to the deeps, 'I'm here, I'm here, I'm here.' And the deeps do answer. Yes, they do. About this time of year," he said, studying the murk and fog, "something comes to visit the lighthouse. I've put off telling you, because you might think I'm daft. Tonight's the night it comes. Just sit down there. If you want, tomorrow you can pack your duffel and take the motorboat into land and get your car parked there at the dinghy pier on the Cape and drive on back to some little inland town and keep your lights burning nights. I won't question or blame you. It's happened 3 years now, and this is the only time anyone's been here with me to verify it. You wait and watch." Half an hour passed, with only a few whispers between us. "One day, many years ago, a man walked along and stood in the sound of the ocean on a cold, sunless shore and said, 'We need a voice to call across the water, to warn ships. I'll make one. I'll make a voice like all of time and all of the fog that ever was. I'll make a voice that is like an empty bed beside you all night long, and like an empty house when you open the door, and like trees in autumn with no leaves. A sound like the birds flying south, crying, and a sound like November wind and the sea on the hard, cold shore. I'll make me a sound and an apparatus, and they'll call it a foghorn. And whoever hears it will know the sadness of eternity and the briefness of life.
The foghorn blew.
I made up that story, said McDonald quietly, to try to explain why this thing keeps coming back to the lighthouse every year.
But, I said, psst, said McDonald.
There!
He nodded out to the deeps. Something was swimming toward the lighthouse tower. And then, from the surface of the cold sea, came a head. A large head, dark-colored with immense eyes, and then a neck, and then, not a body, but more neck, and more. The head rose a full 40 feet above the water, on a slender and beautiful dark neck. Only then did the body, like a little island of black coral and shells and crayfish, drip up from the subterranean. There was a flicker of tail. In all, from head to tip of tail, I estimated the monster at 90 or 100 feet.
"Steady, boy, steady," whispered McDonald.
"It's impossible," I said.
"No, Johnny, we're impossible. It's like it always was 10 million years ago. It hasn't changed. It's us and the land that have changed, become impossible. Us!"
It swam slowly and with a great dark majesty out in the icy waters, far away. The fog came and went about it, momentarily erasing its shape. One of the monster eyes caught and held and flashed back our immense light, red, white, like a disk held high and sending a message in primeval code. It was as silent as the fog through which it swam.
"Dinosaur of some sort,"
I crouched down, holding to the stair rail.
"Yes, one of the tribe."
"But they died out?"
"No, only hid away in the deeps. Deep, deep down in the deepest deeps. Isn't that a word now, Johnny? A real word. It says so much. The deeps."
The foghorn blew, and the monster answered. A cry came across a million years of water and mist, a cry so anguished and alone that it shuddered in my head and my body. The foghorn blew. The monster roared again. The foghorn blew. The monster opened its great toothed mouth, and the sound that came from it was the sound of the foghorn itself. Lonely and vast and far away. The sound of isolation, a viewless sea, a cold night, apartness. That was the sound.
"Now," whispered McDonald, "do you know why it comes here?"
I nodded.
"Perhaps it's a million years old, this one creature. Think of it, waiting a million years. Could you wait that long? Maybe it's the last of its kind. I sort of think that's true."
I saw it all. I knew it all. The million years of waiting alone for someone to come back who never came back, while the skies cleared of reptile birds, the swamps dried on the continental lands, the sloths and saber-tooths had their day and sank in tar pits, and men ran like white ants upon the hills. The foghorn blew. The monster was only 100 yards off now, it and the foghorn crying at each other. As the lights hit them, the monster's eyes were fire and ice, fire and ice.
"That's life for you," said McDonald. "Someone always waiting for someone who never comes home. Always someone loving something more than that thing loves them. And after a while you want to destroy whatever that thing is, so it can't hurt you no more."
The monster was rushing at the lighthouse,
The foghorn blew. "Let's see what happens," said McDonough. He switched the foghorn off. The ensuing minute of silence was so intense that we could hear our hearts pounding in the glassed area of the tower, could hear the slow, greased turn of the light. The monster stopped and froze. Its great lantern eyes blinked. Its mouth gaped. It gave a sort of rumble, like a volcano. It twitched its head this way and that, as if to seek the sounds now dwindled off into the fog. It peered at the lighthouse. It rumbled again. Then its eyes caught fire. It reared up, threshed the water, and rushed at the tower, its eyes filled with angry torment. "McDonough," I cried, "switch on the horn!" McDonough fumbled with the switch, but even as he flicked it on, the monster was rearing up. I had a glimpse of its gigantic paws, fish skin glittering in webs between the finger-like projections, clawing at the tower. The huge eye on the right side of its anguished head glittered before me like a cauldron into which I might drop, screaming. The tower shook. The foghorn cried. The monster cried. It seized the tower and gnashed at the glass, which shattered in upon us. McDonough seized my arm. "Downstairs!" We reached the bottom as the tower buckled down toward us. We ducked under the stairs into the small stone cellar. There were a thousand concussions as the rocks rained down. The foghorn stopped abruptly. The monster crashed upon the tower. The tower fell. We knelt together, McDonough and I, holding tight, while our world exploded. Then it was over, and there was nothing but darkness and the wash of the sea on the raw stones. That and the other sound. "Listen," said McDonough quietly. "Listen." First a great vacuumed sucking of air, and then the lament, the bewilderment, the loneliness of the great monster folded over and upon us. The monster gasped and cried. The tower was gone. The light was gone. The thing that had called to it across a million years was gone. And the monster was opening its mouth and sending out great sounds. The sounds of a foghorn, again and again. And ships far at sea, not finding the light, not seeing anything, but passing and hearing late that night, must have thought, "There it is, the lonely sound, the lonesome bay horn. All's well. We've rounded the cape." And so it went for the rest of that night. The sun was hot and yellow the next afternoon when the rescuers came out to dig us from our stoned-under cellar. "It fell apart, is all," said Mr. McDonough gravely. "We had a few bad knocks from the waves, and it just crumbled." He pinched my arm. The next year they built a new lighthouse, but by that time I had a job in the little town and a wife and a good, small, warm house that glowed yellow on autumn nights, the doors locked, the chimney puffing smoke. As for McDonough, he was master of the new lighthouse, built to his own specifications, out of steel-reinforced concrete. "Just in case," he said. The monster? It never came back. I sat in my car, listening. I couldn't see the lighthouse or the light standing out in Lonesome Bay. I could only hear the horn, the horn, the horn. It sounded like the monster calling. I sat there, wishing there was something I could say. That was The Foghorn by Ray Bradbury, read by Sean Barrett.
Ray Bradbury's short stories are produced by Matt Thompson and are a Rocket House production for BBC Radio.
Right. Thank you, mate.
Oh, cheers.
Makes you feel sorry for the little monster, you know?
It does. Yeah, they teased him, man. That's not cricky.
Yeah. Cricket. It's not cricket.
Cricket? That's not cricket.
That's not cricket.
That's not cricket.
Crikey. Crikey, that's not cricket.
Yes, no cricket at all. Crikey, yeah. Cricket at all. Crikey. Well, it's not crikey either.
I mean, poor dinosaur thought he was...
Poor sea monsters.
Going to be enjoying himself. But nope. He was lied to.
As we all are.
Yes. Yes. It's so true. So true.
Ah, true. Just another monster from the depths of the ocean, a few miles away from Parma. Did I hear Parma?
If one of us was ready, you would have heard Parma. That's for sure. If one of us was ready. Which one it is. There we go. Thank you. Little Parma. Never hurt anybody. So, yeah, the movie
Never.
Was only loosely based on this short story, but... I think they had the romantic part with the lighthouse was a little more subdued in the movie. Perhaps they were afraid of ratings. I don't know.
Could be.
Yeah, Harry Hansen, although he had, let us just say, very attractive people in his movies, he never gave in to, like, out-and-out exploitation, let us say. He always was tasteful,
okay.
Harryhausen. And similarly, as was Bradbury's work.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And they became great friends, him and Harryhausen.
Yeah, and Florey Ackerman, the three of them. In fact, if you're looking at the little slideshow, there's a nice picture of them from, like, I want to say the 90s, where they were still all alive.
Oh, yeah.
And we lost them all in the early 2000s, in the aughts, as it were. At least they all got to see the new millennium.
They did.
Yep.
And they didn't predict it that way either, so, you know.
That's right. But we got a little bit more Bradbury on Bradbury. Short little clip here.
Okay, cool.
Let's get that in there. We've got some time to kill.
You write about the elements. You write about fire. You write about wind. What made you write your short story called The Wind?
Again, you're always looking for things that terrify you. And you make lists of things out of your childhood. For instance, late at night, two things used to scare me: the sound of the wind, if it got too strong, whining through the screens or coming down the chimney. Or late at night, at 3 o'clock in the morning, a locomotive would run along out in the country. And I would go, ooh, and that would be the ghost of my dead cousin. I hadn't had a cousin who died and was buried out on a farm somewhere when I was 7 or 8 years old. And when that locomotive would go by at night, and it would sound like the ghosts haunting the earth, demanding to be back, wanting to be alive again. And I'd crouch in my bed, and I'd snuggle up to my brother because I was afraid the locomotive would come get me. Huh? So that's a memory you remember, and you put it in a book like Something Wicked This Way Comes Later.
It's amazing. Amazing the way he wrote, and he shares his thought processes. Still there, kids?
Yeah, I don't know this. I don't know this, I have an explanation for the stories that I've come up with in the past. I don't know.
They just come.
Some of them,
you.
Perhaps, but most of them were come up. You know, and I never really had the whole story plotted out. Because when I sat down to write one of the radio plays, I knew where it was starting, I knew where I wanted it to end, and the rest of it in the middle was a surprise to me as I was writing it.
Some people like to say they let the characters tell the story. They create the characters, and then they let the characters tell the story.
I've always said that my characters are so much more clever than I am because, you know, they would say it instantly. It would take me sometimes 15 minutes to come up with a good line for them, but they would say it right off the cuff. So I always said that my characters were far more clever than I was.
That's great. We got some time left.
Oh. We do.
Whatever shall we do with it, as if I don't know? Wheel.
How about the wheel?
Hey, I know. Let's do the wheel.
Wheel.
All right, I guess I'll go. Cool. No, if you want to, ladies first.
Oh, thank you very much. And since I'm right here, spin to win, here we go.
Around and around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows.
What's on your mind, James?
You may. I shall reply civilly, as is my wont.
All right. What's on your mind?
A crisis has arose, Miss Rogers. I am the recipient of a telegram informing me of the arrival in our city tomorrow of a certain eminent personage, a personage so exalted I hesitate to mention his name.
You don't mean...
Yes, Umbria.
My, that is an exalted personage. But, Jimmy, just where does the crisis come in?
His wire says, please get me a date for my first night in Hollywood.
Oh.
Would prefer an Academy Award winner who can dance.
I see. And so you came to me, hmm?
Naturally. Gary Cooper is too tall.
I'm very flattered.
Oh, tut, tut, my dear Rogers. Your idol, your ideal, the way they spell him here is terrible. Know how to spell. I'll start from the beginning. You're ideal for Umbriago. You're so, shall I say, très décolleté? Or shall I say something I understand?
I think perhaps you'd better.
You know, I'm convinced, Miss Rogers, that you're just Umbriago's type.
Oh, really?
Sure, you're a dame, ain't you? But first, I must make sure you're romantic enough for Umbriago.
For Umbriago?
Yeah, I'll make believe I'm him. Ginger, you and me are out in the moonlight under the magnolia tree. Mm. You nestle your head on my shoulder and sigh with extra say.
Mm-hmm.
Spelt E-X-T-R-A-S-A-Y. The magic of the moonlight is coursing through my veins. I am irresistible to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm getting is, huh? You grab me. I struggle, but you're too strong for me. Before I know it, you shower my upturned face with burning kisses.
Mm-hmm.
Be mine, you say. I want you. I need you. I must have you. Say, wait a minute. What am I worrying about Umbriago for? This dame is stuck on me.
Well, Jimmy, before you fan our burning love into a forest fire, I think I'd better tell you I can't possibly go out with you or Umbriago tomorrow night.
And why, pray, if I may be so bold, not?
Well, because I have a date already, you see.
A matter of extreme inconsequency.
Do you mind saying that again, please?
You've got to break your date.
Well, I wouldn't think of it, Jimmy. There's something that that's something that I wouldn't do for to any human being.
Forget about human beings. I'm offering you a date with a member of my family. I must pull myself together. Only trouble in it's a little hard to tell where to start pulling. There's so many loose ends. I know what I need. Entertainment. I'll entertain myself. Music, Major. 8 to a note, please. You know, I just got back from Hollywood today. And really, folks, I've got a lot to say. While I was there, I met President Will Hayes. And what he told me put me in a daze. wife for days and 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 days for a week. Everybody puts in extra notes. But I'll overlook it. Mr. Hayes says, Jimmy, you've been invited to entertain at the White House. He said it'll be a gala of the intelligentsia, the hoi polloi, the 400, the 300, the 200, the 100. That's when I walked in. Mr. Hayes says, Jimmy, what you do when you call upon to entertain? Is the cameras grinding? I said, Mr. Hayes, what'll I do? Why, in the midst of festivities, I'll get up and do my strut away. In my cutaway, it's just a hop away, a scram away, and a scram away. And then you sit it right down, you go to town with a twist away. Where's the mic when you twist away? This way, it's a holiday. You know, all over town, they're doing the Susie Q. Why, they did that dance years ago. I'm the Rudy LaPoo, but not my strut away. In my cutaway, why, it's a dance that's gonna gain great renown. You know, a beautiful gal invited me up to her apartment to teach her this dance. I was in the apartment 10 minutes when who walks in? Her husband. Kind of perturbed. He says, what are you doing here? I said, I'm putting on my white tie. I'm putting on my top hat. I'm putting on my top coat to make my getaway. Doing the strut away. Did you ever have the feeling that you wanted to do the strut away? The hop away, the scram away, and then you see the right down and you go to town doing a strut away. Let me hear that band, Major. That's the boy. Another chorus. Hit it. I'll do a strut away in my cutaway. It's just a hop away, a slide away, and a scram away. And then you skin it right down, you go to town with a twist away. Why, when you strut away, this way it's a holiday. You know, all over town, they're doing the Susie Q. They did that dance years ago. I'm the Rudy LaPoo, but not my strut away. In my cutaway, why, it's a dance that's gonna gain great renown. You know, I walked into a drugstore, and I ordered a banana split with whipped cream and pistachio nuts. Went for nothing, a guy hits me over the head with a bottle and said, consider yourself launched. Well, I'm a gentleman, I apologize, but he wasn't satisfied. He demanded an autopsy. So I ups to him, I face with my right, I face with my left, I seize an opening, I'm flat on my back. So what did I do? I did the crawl away, not the strut away. Did you ever have the feeling that you wanted to do the strut away? The hop away, the scram away. And then you get it right down and you go to town doing a strut away. Let me hear it. Let me hear it, Major. Hey, hey.
See, you don't have to wait until in the after party for Jimmy Durante today.
Yeah.
Along
with Ginger Rogers there. Yeah. Absolutely. It might even have time to slip in a wooden nickel into the jukebox for a single play, do we? Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Let's see here. Yeah, nickel,
just the single.
Nickel. Rolling my ass off.
And here are Kurt Massey, the Ambassadors, and the Andrews Sisters.
Cry together, Let's love a time together.
You're gone from me, but in my memory, we always will be together. We sing along together.
Love's own sweet song. Together.
When things go wrong together,
then I'll hold your hand and I'll understand.
If you should sing without me, make sure you sing about me.
And I do.
All my dreams will come true. For it's me with you together. We've always sung together like birds of a feather since we were young together. Climbed every rung together.
Together with us next weekend. We're having a train wreck, man. It's gonna be just like a Miz Adams.
Another one.
Yes.
Another one.
Yeah, this time they'll be just stories.
Okay.
On Friday it's High Adventure, Suspense, and Crisis, and then Saturday, a week from tonight, it's the return of CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Yep.
That's
sounds like
weekend.
A bang-up good time.
And if you haven't already, you might want to jump on over to the Twitches there and get ready for Gar. The Ghoul, Horrible Horror, Sengar the Ghoul. It'll be a repeat. Our poor brother not feeling well.
No.
Yep.
Again, feel better with Gar. Feel better.
Absolutely.
And we want to thank Fogsbane and good old Bob stopped by for a little bit. Angels Asylum stopped in. Hey. Good times. And plus billions and billions
nice
more we can't see.
Billions and billions. Thank you, Carl. Yeah. Thank you, Carl. Billions and billions. Or is it thank you, McDonald's, for billions and billions?
Ah, that health food McDonald's, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Spam, for being
well,
spam.
I remember when the sign said only 1 million served.
Wow.
You must
be old, man.
I'm old.
Oh, man.
I'm older than Burger Chef and Jeff, man.
You're older than Burger Chef and Jeff?
Yeah.
That's going back there. Older than Shasta. Well, thanks again for joining us. More radio fun next weekend. Right here on Erie House Radio.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him.
And her!
When next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.
Can you dig it? You closed the door. Very tidy.
Ooh, very nice. Very nice. Very
nice. Nice one. Very nice.
That was a nice, nice ending there.
Yes, for a change. Yeah.
And Ray Bradbury is like a guy you can never get quite enough of.
Wherever you are. Yes.
Yeah.
He's in the afterlife with his two friends. He's in the afterworld with his two friends, Florian and Ray. Oh, I wish I could see what they were doing.
And Heinlein. Owen.
Yep. Robert Heinlein. Heinlein.
Yep.
Boy, that's some early sci-fi.
Yeah.
And Stan Freeberg. Yep.
I read, the earliest stuff I probably ever read was Bradbury as a youth. But quite early on, I started dabbling in like Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov a little bit, which was a little deep.
Yeah, good
stuff, though.
Well, it's because those two had a heavy education in science, in hard science. So,
yes.
Thus the deep, deep, deep stuff.
Yeah, Clark was well read, as was Asimov, both of them, and they tried to make their sci-fi credible.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the average American was becoming more and more educated,
Like, well, and science, in some cases, were starting to catch up with us in the 50s,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were already shooting rudimentary rockets up in the air in the 50s.
Yep.
Yeah. Just get some duct tape, a tin can, shoot it into space, and you're good.
Those Estes rockets are fun. I never had a staged rocket. They were all one stagers. Yeah, I wonder if those work well, the staged rockets. Because they have some that go way, way, way high in the air. You want to definitely go on no wind day or you ain't recovering nothing. Most of them have a parachute and a recoverable.
Yeah. I'm wondering when someone makes a drone that you can put in space and bring.
That would be interesting. You cut out on us a little bit, but the drone in space idea, I like that.
Your very, yeah, your very own spy satellite, now available by Milton Bradley.
I wonder when the police, the police are probably already using them. They should.
Oh, I'm sure the NSA or the other alphabet soups are probably using that.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, well, there's one right over here.
Let's just say I'll be looking over my shoulder when I'm doing my taxes.
Yes. Hello, Mr. K.
I do anyway.
IRS. Yeah. Yes, you can't put that many zeros there for a deduction, or you can't deduct that.
What do you mean? My dog.
You can't deduct what?
My dog is not a deduction? What are you, a speciesist? Why, I oughta. Animals are good people.
That's it, gentlemen. I really must be away. They are very good people. So are robots.
Well, and that
so everyone
in that case, in that case, you know what has to be done.
Indeed. I have to find him.
My task at hand.
I'd buy ginger under.
Yeah, push the goat. Yeah. Behind the goat, too. So, Mr. Durante, once again, as always, the stage belongs to you.
Good night.
Good night.
It's time to say
that's good night, Coop.
What more is this say but good night?
Good
We've
night.
Had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo.
Toodaloo. Oliver, Inca.
Good night. Good night, folks. And good night,
and
Mrs.
Good
Calabash.
Night, Mrs. Calabash.
And you are good.
Wherever you are. Ha-cha-cha.